Accession number 26599, Reel 3.
John Krish, Reel 3. John, the war's now over and you're back in Civvy Street.
Yes.
I know your post-war filmmaking work was actually prodigious. And I mean, you worked for many different organisations.
Right.
Did you find that making films for the services, as opposed to an outsider, did you find that making films for the services, as in effect an outsider, a very different prospect to that of other commissioning organisations? So in your Civvy Street capacity, when you came to work for the services again, as an outsider?
Yes. No, I got it. Yes.
Did you find yourself in more difficult circumstances? Were they better or the same or worse to deal with as commissioning organisations?
I think they were worse than anybody else.
I mean, could you say a little about
the
sort of post-war involvement? I mean, we're talking about the services.
Yes, no, I'm with you.
And I know your other work.
Yes, no, we'll stick to the services. AKC, for instance.
Yes.
And the Air Force and the Navy, for whom I worked for all three services.
Yes.
I think I touched on this at the retrospective, that people wanted work from the services. Documentary making companies wanted films from the services because they were the bread and butter, and there were plenty of films around to be made from the services, from all three. And so there was a bit of, from the producers, from the head of these documentary companies, which were generally very small and needy, there was a kind of subservience going on to people like Jackman and Rich, Todd Rich and Fred Jackman, was it, at AKC? They ran it anyway. And I always had the feeling that at every meeting that I had with the head of with the producer of the documentary company and them, these two who were running the AKC, who were civilians, they were not army, that one had to watch what one said. And are we on? Is it working?
Sorry. No, that's fine.
Yes? Good. Yes? Yes. That the meetings at Dover Street, which is where I think they were not relaxed. That both Todd Rich and Jackman made it quite clear that they were in charge. And I found those meetings really very unpleasant. Everything had to be submitted to them. Casting, for instance, they had to approve. I remember when I did Break-In, I had to parade the cast in front of them. And when they saw Jim Dale, they said, "But he doesn't look like a crook." And I said, "That is the point." And it was that kind of lack of intelligence which I found very difficult. Todd Rich was somebody who cherished his time in the army and wore a British warm with the holes where the bits and pieces had been. And they were both very pompous people, very humourless people, who had to be humoured. And I don't find somebody else's arse a terribly comfortable place to be, frankly, you know.
Is this, do you think, the individuals, or is it a reflection of the organisation itself?
No, the individuals. They were pompous. for some reason, I was thinking about this coming to you this morning, their presence wasn't there in, when I did Captured. And I don't know why, whether it was because it was for Army Intelligence that they took over. But they had no involvement in it whatsoever. And I don't understand why, but it made my life a lot easier. When going to the other two, the Navy was much more laid back, and so was the Air Force. I did one film for the Air Force, which was about instruction. It was a comedy. And they were very, very liberal-minded. They allowed me a lot of freedom in the way to make it, which I don't think Jackman and Rich, sorry, that went straight into the mic, would have allowed or understood. The film for the Air Force had a really wonderful title. It was called Instructional Technique Part 3. Jesus Christ. Which was, and then in brackets, the instructor. And it was a fantasy. I liked fantasy when putting over a subject. I thought it was a good way through. Because having been in the army, I also mentioned this at the retrospective, having been in the audience for instructional films, I knew how easy it was to fall asleep. And I, now that I was in the position of making films, I didn't want anybody to fall asleep. So every idea I had was to keep the audience awake by whatever means. And in the Air Force, I used fantasy, and it worked. Very unconventional film, all shot in a black set with white wicker furniture. It was a trial about a man who was on trial for his methods of instruction and defended by a fellow instructor who is nearer Lucifer than you can imagine. And I was hoping that the archive would have found it. I mean, it might creak, who knows, but nobody's managed to find it.
Have we looked in our collection?
Yes. No. It would be worth resurrecting for you and I to see and groan about.
The actual process of you getting to the stage of making it, though,
yes.
I mean, where were you? Were you working for another organisation?
I was working for Richard Massingham's company.
And, I mean, how did you then develop? How did the idea come to you? Or how was the project, you know, presented to you?
Oh, he would get the brief that they needed this film on health, on hygiene, personal hygiene, which was a...
This was Health in Our Time.
Yes, that became Health in Our Time, but it started out as a film on personal hygiene.
Can you say a little about that and how it came about? And
yes.
How the process was in order to arrive at the actual...
And how it finished up, sure.
And the end result.
Well, I joined Richard Massingham as his editor. He made films for the government, reminding you to have only 5 inches of water in your bath and how to cross the road and all that kind of thing. And they were funny, but he was very limited and very frightened as a producer because they were living on the edge of poverty all the time. There were only about 4 of us in the permanent staff. And so he was always anxious and sure there'd be no more work. And when a brief arrived from the War Office, from AKC, rather, the Army Kinematograph Corps, for a film, he jumped for joy, of course, and asked me to do it. And this was going to be the first film I directed, and I was very thrilled until I saw that it was called Personal Hygiene, and it was death. It was death. But I said that I thought it needed expanding, and he got very anxious because he thought the film would go somewhere else. But I evolved an idea for it, which the Army Medical side accepted, and so Todd Rich and Jackman had to. And so I made a film about health rather than hygiene. And it split into two. It was shown to everybody who came into the Army, into the peacetime Army, this is. And to make them aware of the dangers of living as a community, where they had come from home, where they'd lived with mum and dad and brother and sister, but now they were having to face a whole new set of of medical problems living as a group, living in a barrack room, that health and hygiene had to be central if they were to stay healthy and keep everybody else healthy. And because I'd had meningitis in the army, the film became very important for me, because I knew what living, because I'd caught it in the army. You know. I mean, the meningitis is, a lot of people carry it, but very few succumb. But it absolutely relishes crowds and barrack rooms, and so that's where I got it. So the film wasn't a chore by any means. It was, of course, it was my first film to direct and to write and to edit. So I did all three. And I was, let me see, I can tell you how old I was, or how young I was. 48. So I was 26. 25, yes, 25. Big responsibility. And, which I didn't see it as such, but looking back I realise, you know, ridiculous to do all three jobs, but I did. And
you were given more or less a free hand.
I was, because the medical side approved of the expansion that I wanted to do. And I wrote the film, as it were, in two halves. The first half, the civilian side of what life was like, with the services that look after us, the National Health Service and sewage and so on. And then the second half, where the army looks after you. And for the civilian side, I got the radio doctor, Charles Hill, to read the commentary and to appear. And that was a very familiar voice in those days. He was on radio once a week, if not more. And so I also put in the film an enormous amount of information so that it was impossible to go to sleep. I mean, you were pounded with it from start to finish. From washing your hands to Hiroshima, that was the scale of the film. And so the film was a success in the services. Then I was asked to do one for the Navy. Now, me and the sea do not get on. Nevertheless, I took it on because I wanted to conquer my imbalance, not fear. It was just my ears or my head or whatever. Maybe it was the meningitis that upset the system. You know, I can't cope with this. So I started the research for it and went on a destroyer, went in a submarine. That was fairly amazing, because to get some information about the Navy, I'd seen Morning Departure, a film with John Mills. And he starts, the film opens with him saying to the crew, well, we're going to the channel, stooge around at kind of periscope depth for a couple of hours and then come back. And they don't come back. They sink to the bottom. So I arrive down at Portsmouth, get on this submarine, and I hear the captain say, we're going to go to the middle of the channel, stooge around for a couple of hours, periscope depth, and come back. And I think, shit me, what have I let myself in for? And I was so tense. The first thing about being in a submarine that you notice is that they leak, which was a surprise when you're under the water. They also smell. They smell of whatever is on for lunch, which was liver and bacon and onions. And no air. And bad breath. I mean, it's not the most delightful place to be. And of course, I couldn't eat liver and bloody onions going backwards and forwards on trays. And as I said, I was so exhausted by having to be interested and take information and, you know, and absorb this, what goes on. The film, I didn't say, was about artificers, who are the craftsmen of the Navy, and are on every ship, as metal workers, chippies, electricians, those are all artificers. And so the film was to encourage boys, when they join the Navy, to take a trade. In fact, I called the film Tiffy. So anyway, here am I in the submarine, and he says we're going to surface, and thank Christ we surfaced. And I go on the bridge, and so we steam back in a force 4 gale into Portsmouth. I am fast asleep on the bridge, standing up. That's what it did to my nervous system. But I then went onto, I never knew what the Navy jargon is, the most exciting place I'd ever been in my life, which was Illustrious, the aircraft carrier. And being on the flight deck for training landings and takeoffs is the most exciting, terrifying place you can imagine. And I stayed on Illustrious, it was at sea, of course, for a week. Piped aboard, I may say. Had to hire some gear, for the wardroom, because they all dressed up for their evening meal. There was no...
You didn't have a crew with you at this time?
No, I was still investigating and writing away. Yeah. And I had a recorder with me, I seem to remember. There was no beer on board because it takes up too much room.
I didn't get rum
because I didn't like it, but it gave me brandy. I got pissed again because of this poisoning from the Americans and was legless again. Oh, God. Oh, Jesus Christ. Anyway, I didn't feel comfortable on board. It was a destroyer or Illustrious, which was very big, but when it was empty of planes, it was as buoyant as a cork. And it didn't suit me, and I came off the film. I gave them the script and said I can't direct it because I really feel so unwell. So it was directed by somebody else. So I've worked for all three services. I was then asked by the Army to do another film, which I turned down. They wanted me to do a film about street fighting, the technique of street fighting, and they wanted it shot in a town they destroyed in Germany. That the RAF had destroyed in Germany. And I just thought that was the most tasteless thing one could ever do. And I turned it down. The only other film I turned down was a film for the COI about the army in Ireland during the height of the IRA. I had a young family at that time. 3 very young children, and I simply wasn't prepared to go. So the film I made for the Air Force was this instructional part 3, and that is all that I've made for the services, apart from Captured, of course.
Can we go on to Captured?
Yes.
I mean, it's a fairly significant film, I mean, in many ways. I mean, it's a feature-length
sure.
film, which was unusual.
Yes, and with actors.
And the story behind it and what happened
yes.
is of some interest. I wonder if you could just
talk yes,
a little
sure.
about how it came about and the whole process of filming it and the end result and how you felt about that.
Well, I was very pleased to be asked to do it because for a documentary director, which I now was, and an established one. For me, there was only one step up, and that was to go into features. But to cross the bridge between documentary filmmaking and feature filmmaking is impossible unless you have something to show to a feature film producer. Something that has a story to it, that has actors, so that the feature producer can see that you can handle dialogue and actors. Well, very few documentaries have dialogue, mostly narration, and almost none had actors, because the budgets were so low and because we were making reality films, and more often than not, when you use so-called real people, as if actors aren't. But anyway, you know what I mean. So here was a chance for me to make a film which would be my visiting card, like no other. I mean, an opportunity in a million. A feature film, feature-length film about a subject which nobody was touching in the feature world, with all the facilities to make it as real as possible, and with actors. And so when I sat down to write investigate, it was just a golden opportunity for me, to coin a cliche.
So the brief was, we want a film of this length, rather than the project itself that you developed came out at that length.
We want a film about interrogation, was the brief. And in talking to interrogators, and the principal one was from the Air Force, and being in and out of MI5 building in Kingsway, anyway, wherever they were centred,
yeah.
I realised that it would have to be dramatised, that you couldn't make a film about interrogation without exchanges happening between people, the interrogator and the prisoner. And so it was going to be a dialogue film. And if it was going to be a dialogue film, it was going to have actors. And if it was going to have a situation that had to be developed and resolved, it was going to be long. It couldn't be a one-reeler. And we talked about, the RAF, technical officer. Old age. Forgive me. He and I got on like anything. He was a bit of a sadist, actually. He loved the idea of interrogation. He was very good, very brainy man. He knew all about the Communist Front and informed me wonderfully well about what Russia was up to within Europe, which is what the film was to be about, because Russia was the enemy and had spies everywhere. You know. And I went on this weekend exercise with territorials. I'd just like you to, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to read what I wrote about that weekend from the notes that I gave at the...
Of course.
Because...
Actually, we could just stop
and yes.
go on to the next slide.
Yes, sure, that would be perfect.
Again,
yes, okay.
Just one thing before we do that. You were working in an independent capacity at this time?
Yes, I had moved from Richard Massingham. Are we on?
Yes, that's
oh, good. I had moved from Richard Massingham to Worldwide, where I made Break-In,
yes.
Which we haven't talked about. We did. We talked about it with Jim Dale, yes. That I was very keen to do, because that again was a film with actors and with dialogue, even though it was only a three-reeler. It would give some idea of what I was... I thought what I was capable of. As it turned out, I think it doesn't do anything of the sort, except for perhaps the end sequence. But that was the construction of it, and shortage of money, that I couldn't have it all dialogue. It was largely narration. And also because of the nature of it, because it is very instructional, and that the kind of formality of taking on an investigation of what you have to do and what you don't have to do had to be spelt out in narration rather than dialogue to make it fit into three reels. Otherwise, I think it would have been much longer. And there was only the money for three reels. But it was good practice for me, working with actors. And I was, you know, lucky to have the chance, because as I say, they're one in 100, those films. So then I was asked to do Captured as a result of Break-In.
Well, perhaps we can then.
Yes. Okay.
Lead into
yeah.
John Krish, Reel 4. John, you were going to give a little bit more background about the film Captured.
Captured. Yes.
Read something from.
Yes. This was. I just thought I would read this because it's as brief as it can be, and I didn't want to kind of grope for what I'd already written about it. The Captured started with a brief from the War Office. They wanted a feature-length film on interrogation. I said, I'm not sure about that, whether they specified it at that point. But they wanted it on the techniques of interrogation, how to interrogate. So, during my research, I spent time with interrogators and went on one of their weekend exercises. A company of territorials had been dropped off around the country and had to reach their target. And they didn't reach their target because they were all captured and then subject to interrogation over the weekend. And in a few short hours, I saw the resistance of highly trained men, these territorials, gradually crumble, which in the minds of the interrogators justified every one of their methods, which were the kind of methods that the Russians used. They were not our methods. They were sleep deprivation, buckets on heads, being hit with iron bars, enormous verbal pressure and insults and so on. And what was extraordinary to me as a spectator, and I was up the entire weekend, I didn't sleep. I was in the room with them, was not seeing through glass or, you know, double-sided mirror or anything like that. I was there alongside the interrogator, and it was horrifying. It seemed to take no time for these weekend prisoners, and that's what they were just weekend prisoners, to lose touch with reality. Their minds couldn't retain the fact that they were territorials, that within 24 hours or so, they'd be at home with their family and back in the office. And if I'd been told this could happen, I simply wouldn't believe it. But what I saw was incredibly chilling. And so the methods that I saw used went into the film. That is, that it was to be about a group of Britons, a group of Russians, forgive me, it's old age, being dropped into Britain. And how each one is captured and interrogated so that their target is finally revealed. And the film and the script I wrote was for a 70-minute film. I may have misled you in thinking that the methods that were used were the Russian methods. They weren't. They were the British methods. There was no overt cruelty. So the script was approved. I started to cast it. And I was really rubbing my hands with joy that I was going to last do a long film with actors and off to features. I got a message from the War Office that I'd been given the wrong brief. They didn't want a film about interrogation. They wanted a film about resistance to interrogation. So I talked to my technical advisor, who was now out of his depth. But we centered on the idea of the Korean War, although he was no longer on it because he had no experience of it. What little he did know was that British prisoners were subjected to things which nobody knew about, methods that they couldn't resist, and extreme cruelty. So I was steered towards, and I can't remember how, Major Farah Hockley, who was the adjutant of the Gloucester Regiment and who'd been a prisoner of the North Koreans. And I spent a long time with him, and he then put me on to his adjutant, a very sweet man called Captain Tony Preston. And he became my technical advisor. And by this time, there'd been a lot of books written about the Korean War. I cannot remember the date of the talk.
58 or was it 59?
Captured was made in 59?
It was 58? Released in 59.
Yeah, so it made in 58, right. So the Korean War was over. And so the Americans had written a lot of books about their suffering. The only army, it was a United Nations war, wasn't it? The first, yes. The first time we'd fought communism, of course. And the only army that hadn't gone under as prisoners of the North Koreans was the Turkish. None of them went, none of them betrayed their comrades. None of them gave broadcasts for the North Koreans. None of them signed peace petitions. But a lot of Americans did. They went under fastest because they hadn't got the PX. And they hadn't got their rations and they hadn't got the discipline. But the Turks had the discipline. A lot of British went under, betrayed, gave broadcasts, signed petitions. Farrah Hockley certainly didn't, nor did Tony Preston. And I don't think many in the Gloucester Regiment did. They were incredibly firm as a